Do you really think all this is an accident? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, Jeff?
The island.
Look, you want to push the button? You do it yourself.
If it's not real, then what are you doing here, Jack? Why did you come back? Why do you find it so hard to believe?
Why do you find it so easy?
It's never been easy!
It's a leap of faith, Jack.
Two players. Two sides. One is light. One is dark.
I see you in another life, brother. We have to go back!
We're gonna need to watch that again.
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast for Season 2, Episodes 23 and 24. It's the Season 2 finale, Live Together, Die Alone. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and what Charles Dickens book do you read before you die in honor of Desmond Hume? I'm gonna go with David Copperfield, because I haven't read it, and it's long, so maybe I could put off dying?
My name is Joanna Robinson, and I'm going to go with Martin Chuzzlewit, just so that I can say, as I'm dying, fetch me my Martin Chuzzlewit. Also, it's very long, so I can also put off dying. But Neil picked a short one.
And I'm Neil Miller, and if I were to read a Charles Dickens book before my death, it would be very impressive that I would know that, as we see in this episode. But I would read A Tale of Two Cities, which I'm told is a short one. So, love a good short one.
Neil has the best probability of being able to see his own death and accomplishing his Charles Dickens goals. Joanna and I, we have to really be safe.
You got to plan ahead.
This sniffles bad news. Time to start reading.
Got to crack open Martin Chuzzlewit.
Guys, welcome to the podcast. You made it to the Season 2 finale. It's a two-part finale, Live Together, Die Alone, but you're only going to get one podcast if you decided to join us for this episode of Lost. Really, who can blame you? It's a great episode of Lost. Episodes of Lost. It aired as one. We'll get into all of that. Welcome to the show. We split it into two parts. The first part we call The Calm, and it is only about the episodes of Lost we have already rewatched, so all of Season 1 and all of Season 2. If you would like to talk about stuff that takes place in Lost from Seasons 3 through Season 6B, don't worry, there's stuff on this podcast for you. It's called The Storm, and it's in the second back half of our podcast. If you want to figure out where these things take place, take a look at your podcasting device. There'll be some time codes on there so you can navigate as needed. Thank you so much for listening to us and sticking with us as we rewatch Lost. You can also support the show by going to patreon.com/stormofspoilers, like that thing I just plugged, the feature of the podcast. And there, it will outline some special content you could get for different levels of donations. That's how Patreon works. But most importantly, any level of donation gets you into our Slack, which is a fantastic place on the internet, and gets you access to a very special series Joanna Robinson has been doing with friend of the pod, Kristen Russo from Buffering the Vampire Slayer. It's called Feels Like the First Time, where Joanna shows Kristen some movies for the very first time. What have you guys recently completed, and can you give us a peek at the future?
Feels like the first time. This last week we watched some Mad Max movies, Thunderdome and Fury Road. It was incredible. Really, really good times. So we got two episodes up, the pre-Mad Max viewing and the post-Mad Max viewing. And so the premise, right, is that Kristen has seen all these very famous movies, and I'm showing them to her. So the pre-viewing episodes are her, like, making wild guesses as what's going to happen. And then the post-episodes, we talk about, like, what she thought of it. So we had a great time with Mad Max Fury Road, as you might imagine, and we endured a Mel Gibson movie to get there. And coming up, we're running a poll right now. It was neck and neck for a while, Fast and Furious versus some Batman movies, but Batman is swooping ahead. So it looks like we're going to be doing some Gotham City, spending some time in Gotham City, is what's going to happen. So yeah, so you can join the Patreon at our, like, lowest level, on Patreon. patreon.com/stormofspoilers and get access to all of those, you know, podcasts. And we do live tweets as we watch the movies. It's been a fun quarantine project. We've also been doing some live watches in our Patreon supported Slack. We watched the film Can't Hardly Wait last weekend, which was really fun. We also watched this season two finale, two-part finale of Lost with our listeners in there as well. So we had a bunch of watch parties this weekend with our pals in the Patreon Slack. So yeah, we got a lot of good stuff going on there. Neil is watching all of Breaking Bad in there. It's just, you know, it's a party every day in the Storm Slack. So we'd love to have you if you want to join us. That's not the only way you can be in touch with us. There's a couple other ways. You can always email us. We have a bunch of emails to read this week because the season two finale is, you know, a big important time, but they are all spoilery. So you will find them in the storm. We did not get any calm emails this week, but I do have a review and we love a review. So please do leave us reviews, but I have a review that I can read in the calm here. This is from the final Pam, and 5 stars. Lost was good, comma, actually. and the final Pam writes, in a world where we have been inundated with bad Lost was never good takes for the last 10 years, I love this largely positive show. While the final season of the show made some capital C choices, it absolutely nailed its emotional moments. The show's 3 hosts are charming, fun, and insightful, and make great company for a rewatch I started of this unbingeable show in a depressive funk last August. It is truly the golden age of rewatch pods alongside the official Scrubs rewatch and advanced community studies. Love the pod. Keep up the excellent work. So thank you, the final Pam. Yeah. And I've heard some really good things about that Scrubs rewatch podcast. So nice plug for that show. So yeah, so you can, you know, you can get in touch with us in those various ways. You can always go to stormpodcast.com to sort of see what we're up to in terms of the schedule. Yes, we will be diving directly into season 3 next week. We are not taking a break between seasons. We're really excited to just keep rolling along. And you can also follow us on Twitter at stormpodcast. It's another good way to keep in touch with what we're up to. So those are all the ways. Or you can send up a large black column of smoke and maybe we will see you.
We will send our producer, Diana, to find you.
Yeah. Go to the beach, Diana, and send up the smoke. Before we jump into the calm, also, we might have a little bonus interview episode pod that was supposed to be attached to here, but for scheduling reasons, is gonna float around. Might be attached to a season 3 episode, might be its own thing, but as Joanna mentioned, the best way to check our release schedule is at stormpodcast.com, or just keep listening to us. We'll be back here every week telling you the most up-to-date information, but for those in between days, stormpodcast.com. All right, we're into it now. Neil, what happened this week on the island?
Yes, this week in this 2-part season finale, which was directed by Jack Bender, who you are aware of at this point, and written by Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse, two handsome gentlemen. It aired on May 24th, 2006. It takes place on days 65 through 67 on the island. That is 3 whole days on the island. It's a big deal. In flashbacks, we follow Desmond's journey from prison all the way to the island and beyond. Along the way, we meet Penny, who Desmond loves. We meet Penny's father, Charles Widmore, who sucks. We meet up with Libby and her boat. And we meet Kelvin Inman, who was in the hatch when Desmond landed on the island, you know, the first time. We also hear tales of a wild Redzinski, but we'll get to him. On the island this week, picking up where we left off last episode, Desmond is the one in the boat. He has returned with a sailboat that he never mentioned to anyone before, but not on purpose. He was trying to escape, but failed despite knowing how to sail, as we find out in the flashback. He's now convinced that the island is an inescapable snow globe and that everything else is gone. On the beach, Jack and Saeed concoct a plan to fool Michael and the others. While Michael leads Jack, Kate, Hurley, and Sawyer across the island, Saeed sails the new community boat to the others' village, Tent City, with fellow hot people Sun and Jin. It might have worked if it weren't all a ruse by the others. Saeed and company end up on the wrong side of the island as their friends are captured in a clearing. But not not before they discover all the notebooks from the Pearl Station are just sort of sitting out in the middle of the jungle. It's great. In Hatch Drama, John Locke becomes very sure that pushing the button doesn't matter, which leads to a skirmish with Mr. Echo and the ultimate recruitment of Desmond to aid in his nihilistic quest. That all goes pretty well until Desmond realizes that the electromagnetic danger is very much real and that he very much probably crashed Flight 815. This one gets pretty wild down the home stretch. Desmond terminates the system in the hatch with Locke and Echo inside. Quote-unquote Henry shows back up as the leader of the others. Michael and Walt leave on a boat. Jack, Kate, and Sawyer are taken back home by the others while Hurley is released to return to the beach and tell the tale. It all ends with a scene in an Arctic research station where two Portuguese-speaking men detect an electromagnetic anomaly. And guess what? They work for a penny.
What?
Yeah, I know. Crazy. Fun fact, Michael leaves the island in this episode. So maybe that very well could be the last we ever see of Michael. This week's calm question, and this is, I'm stealing this from a poll that we did on our Twitter, at Storm Podcast on Twitter. When you watch the season 2 of Lost for the first time, do you remember believing in the button, or did you think it was all fake? Or do you not remember at all? What do you think? Joanna, do you remember the first, your button feelings?
Oh, my button feelings. My 2006 button feelings. No, I don't remember. Sorry.
Dave?
I should be feeling
Sorry. Mine wasn't in 2006, so I hadn't picked up the show at this point. So I definitely was team Locke, which is like I found another video that's a newer video that explains this is a psychological experiment, because I always thought the initial commitment to the button seemed like a little weird, and then yeah, so I'm gonna say I thought the button was a lie.
Okay, I want to say that I thought the button was real mostly because of the magnetism. Like the belt thing, stuff like that, where there's like a real, obviously a huge magnet behind that wall. And I was like, there's at least some of this has to be real.
That, Dave, did that belt look like bad polygons to you?
Yes, that belt was absolutely bad polygons. As a matter of fact,
2006 me was way into bad polygons.
This episode was shot, they finished writing it, I think, 4 weeks before it aired. It was shot in 17 days with two crews simultaneously. It was cut during production by 4 different editors. And then a week before it aired, when they handed it off for special effects treatments, they realized they didn't like the final ending scene. So they went and shot the Antarctica penny stuff 5 days before the episode aired. The original ending scene was, I think, Penny and Charles Widmore, like, at Widmore's company, and Widmore received a printout, basically the same thing the Antarctica guys say on the phone. But for whatever reason, even after having shot that in, like, editing, they decided that wasn't good enough or surprising enough for the show, and so they put it all together. But also because it was under that abbreviated schedules, there's some, like, mix-ups in here, but a lot of them have been corrected for the season 2 DVD and all streaming services, so you don't notice them much anymore. But there was a picture of Penny in orientation that was a different actress. Yes. That has since been digitally replaced. Mr. Echo has his cross on during the whole hatch explosion, which somebody pointed out, if it was attracted to the electromagnet before, it would definitely be going crazy during the thing. So they added in a shot of Echo turning his head really fast and CGI'd the necklace coming off and then took it off for all remaining shots that it was on. And then because the episode needs to be split into two sections, they actually cut parts out of scenes or would end scenes early. So I didn't realize this while it was happening, while we were all live watching along, but those of us that were live streaming on something like Hulu were actually getting a couple seconds ahead of people who were watching the DVD versions, where they had an extra 30 or 20 second capper to the end of some of the scenes.
Oh, that actually makes a lot of sense now.
And yeah,
I was wondering why I was a couple seconds behind toward the end of the watch. And it's because I was watching on Blu-ray.
Yeah, so you had the full shebang, but that also a little bit, a few more lines at the beginning of ending scenes than we did on the streaming thing. But the assembly of the episode also isn't super clean in terms of character motivations, which I'll talk a little bit about in the official podcast check-in, because they apologize for something in this episode. When they watch it, they're like, yes, we skipped a character motivation because we had to cut something out. We will cover that later, but let's talk about something else cool about this episode. It's a Desmond flashback episode.
And Desmond!
Hey!
You know what I'm really gratified by? So, like, watching our newcomers, you know, watch the show for the first time, and they all seem to really like Desmond, and I think you'd have to be living in a hole in the ground to, like, not know. I mean,
I think we said that we'd see him again or something on our episode.
Yeah, I mean,
it's really hard not to be like...
Yeah, we said that, but also, like, I mean, I just think it's, it's hard to hide the fact that...
Yeah, like, if you saw a Lost commercial on television from season 3 to season 6B, you know that Desmond's still in the show later.
Yeah, if you've seen the header photo on our website, you know that Desmond is on the show.
I mean, and it's also, just like, quote-unquote Henry. That guy was also, always coming back.
Quote-unquote Henry Gale. That guy seems important. So anyway, they really liked Desmond and they were really excited to have him come back. But what was really gratifying in the live watch that we did, over the weekend was how much they immediately loved Penny. You know, which same, but like, it just, I was like, Sonya Walker still works. She still works on everyone. Penny.
So now we get to, you know, talk about Penny and Desmond because we get, their backstory, the mysterious Widmore who has been hinted at through mostly alternate reality game stuff, but throwaway lines, I think a crane banner in like the background of one of Charlie's episodes.
Yeah.
Like that sort of thing is now coming into the show as season two sort of acts as like the season two finale rounds off a lot of things that we had questions about this season pretty definitively with stuff like the button, but then also goes crazy with the new mysteries. So we have Desmond got kicked out of the army for some reason. He says for like not following orders, but we don't know why. So we pick up with him when he's like getting out of prison. He's already been like in love with Penny. We don't really know much about that relationship. Widmore doesn't like him, thinks he's a coward. We don't know much about that. And now we sort of get thrust into another hard left turn, which is Desmond's boat that he shows up with on the island was actually gifted to him by Libby, and it's like named after her. And then from that point on, every Desmond scene in his flashback just gets weirder and weirder and more interconnected until I think the, you know, peak, where we realize that not only is Penny still going to wait for him no matter what, in theory, thanks to her note and our mutual friend, but Locke and Desmond, you know, had a fate meetup in season one, and then we get to see, like, the other side of it. So, in terms of how flashbacks operate in Lost, as we've seen in season one and season two, I love this. There was a lot of pushback at this point, because Lost is in 2006, it won like an Emmy or was nominated for an Emmy for like best drama in season one. It wasn't in season two. There was a whole bunch of talk that like Lost got too dark. Lost went too sci-fi. And that was like a bad word because at that point in like 2006, you have like this and maybe Battlestar Galactica.
We can't nominate sci-fi for an Emmy award.
Not the sci-fi. Mm. Not the Sopranos is still on. but like, I really like Lost. I think this is like a peak, Lost flashback working with its, you know, island story really well, because not only does it make you absolutely care about this love story in one episode, which is pretty great, but it also just throws absolutely everything mythologically at the wall, and it uses, Desmond as a character to sort of like pose and answer a certain number of questions about the hatch, while meanwhile, like answering, the majority of our other questions, we had before 3 minutes. I don't know really if we had any of our other questions definitively answered. But Neil, what was your favorite part of our Desmond flashbacks?
Well, you know, Penny. It's mostly just Penny. She's the best. I mean, I like this as the extended flashback across both parts, because it is right our first actual Desmond flashback.
Yeah,
we had met him before, but we had not flashback. So we get a huge download of information about Desmond, and I think it does two things really well. One, like you said, it really sells the Desmond Penny connection. Because, you know, Desmond Penny, very much in love. You know, we don't have a lot of that on the island.
You need is one person waiting for you.
Right. And it's like a big theatrical, you know, existential kind of love. Like, it's not like, the Claire giving Charlie a little kiss there at the end of this episode. It's not that. And then I also think it's a really good way to bring in another to solidify Desmond as sort of a main character and to bring him, you know, to kind of bring him up to speed with all of the other characters that we know of. So it's a really good use of the amount of time they had with these flashbacks.
And season two is so fascinating because, as we've talked before in the storm, but I can bring some of it into the calm now. Season two is a failure to launch for a few different characters, right? Like, mm-hmm. Annalicia the way that they launched her character didn't wind up really working, for people. And, you know, and then she died anyway. And then, you know, Libby dies. And so at this point.
Well, as of right now.
Oh, right. Do you want to bleep that out? I don't know.
It's hard to talk about these season finales.
Well, and okay, so then but there are two characters that they didn't mean to have, like, didn't really fully plan for. There's Henry, quote-unquote Henry Gale,
mm-hmm.
who, as we find out in this finale, it, like, seems to be in charge of at least this segment of the others, right?
Right.
And the maybe aliens.
And so, you know, we can assume that's not the last we've seen of him. But, as we discussed in the storm, and I don't think we've mentioned in the calm, he was only supposed to be around for a couple episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael Emerson was so good that they sort of, like, figured out more to do with him. So that's a success story for the launch of that character. And then Desmond, similarly, was only supposed to be at the beginning of the season, but he was, like, so popular and they liked him so much that they bring him back here at the end and he will have more to do. And so this idea that they, like, couldn't launch the characters that they really planned for, but accidentally stumbled backwards into these two great character, quote unquote, Henry Gale and Desmond Hume. I think that's fascinating. Mm-hmm. Happy accidents of writing, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, the bringing back of Desmond leads us to two more characters who are now deeply fat. Like, I think that both Penny and her father are immediately interesting as a mm-hmm. storyline. Like, I really do want to know where all this went wrong. And they do a good job of not giving us too much information up front. Like, Dave said, we don't really know, you know, why Charles Woodmore does. I always assumed it was because he was, like, lower class. Like, I assume it was like a classism thing. He was in the army.
I think the performances really bring it all the way through because mm-hmm. not only are all the actors, like, giving you so much more than's on the page, but if you, like, talk your way through this plot, it's dumb. It's like, man, dishonorably discharged from army prison, meets his crush's rich father who says, stay away from my daughter. And he says, no, I'm not going to stay away from my daughter. But he does stay away from the daughter and decides he's going to beat the guy at his own game by winning a boat race around the world.
Right. He's going to win the guy's boat race to prove that he's an honorable, courageous man.
And this is something that I've also talked about, I think, in the storm, but is viable here, which is Lost is at its best when it's doing, like, poignant love stories. That's what it does the very best. And so when you have people like when Sun and Jin are separated at the beginning of this season, or, you know, there are some other examples that I can't think of right now, but you, like, you give someone, like, a love interest and you know, and Lindelof proved in The Leftovers and in Watchmen that this is something that he's very interested in covering, and so that's why this has immediate poignancy and urgency. Is you're just sort of like you're rooting for them so hard, and they're separated. He's on an island. What are we gonna do? Desmond has to get back to Penny, like. And she's looking for him. Oh my God. And so, you know.
There was a couple I was rooting for in that Tour de Stade.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Well, and yeah, it's finally a couple we can root for. Cause I think like you get, there's other, especially in flashbacks, you know, we think like John Locke and Helen.
Aww.
Which is, it's a great, you know, once we're into their story, it's really compelling, but it's also tinged with the fact that we know from the start that he does not end up with Helen.
Yeah.
The Desmond thing is different because we don't know what's going to happen with Desmond. You know, like the story that we're going to learn about Desmond and Penny seems more interested in their future, which I think is kind of different for Lost. Like I think that's what made it feel a little bit different the first time around, is like, oh well, now here's the thing that I can root for, that like it's not all doom and gloom.
Not all doom and gloom. Speaking of doom and gloom, doomed couples, we learn that Libby got the boat from her husband named Dave.
Yep.
All Daves are one Dave. We don't know for sure that Libby's husband wasn't the Dave that Hurley saw, because they don't talk about her husband in any future things. I don't know if that's a spoiler to say. Is that a spoiler?
We know that
say?
He was rich enough to have a boat.
He was rich enough to have a boat, and he
real
died.
Boat guy.
Yeah, real boat guy. He died like a month before she gave the boat to Desmond, and that puts it way ahead of when she was in the institution with Hurley, just right. So we have the Libby timeline.
Yeah.
Right. So that, although we got some interview answers that her husband's death eventually put her in the institution, it does seem like there's a time gap where she was at least, you know, somewhat socially functional or presenting.
Well, she was
functional.
Fine until that guy who she gave her boat to with the great love story just disappeared.
Just took her boat and she never saw him again. Never read his name in the papers.
I mean, that would mess me up too.
As Neil and some of our other listeners pointed out, and I just like never, I guess, fully paid attention to this. That scene with Libby and Desmond in the coffee shop only works if you look like Henry Ian Cusack.
Yeah, exactly. There's no way anyone is going to just give you a sailboat if you're.
She's like, let alone even buy her coffee.
Right? She bought him a $4 coffee and then gave him a $42,000 boat.
Libby.
I mean, yeah, well, maybe she was
not of sound
had
mind.
Already begun her descent into needing to be helped.
So that's all our crazy flashbackness. And then, you know, Desmond turns our little key. Oh, that's not all our crazy flashbackness. Kelvin, who was sharp-eyed watchers. Yeah. Sharp-eyed watchers, will notice, was also in, Saeed flashback in one of them, I believe, when we learned about Saeed's background as a torturer. He said in a completely normal, non-accented voice. And now he ended up being Desmond's partner in button pushing on the island, at least for a little while. But it turns out Kelvin might have gone a little quarantine crazy down in the hatch. First of all, faking the quarantine so he could work on Desmond's restored boat. But also we get a couple of quote-unquote answers about the hatch, in that Kelvin and Rosinski have been painting the map with bleach on the door blindly.
I think it's detergent.
Oh yeah, it's actually, the cup is labeled detergent. I'm looking at a screenshot right now. I don't know why I said bleach. Got Trump on the mind. I'm sorry.
I just think about it all the time that Kelvin and Rosinski, for some reason, painted this map with detergent with all the lights on.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then could they turn on the black light to see the map?
they can trigger the door going down. And if the door goes, isn't that what turns off the lights?
I don't know.
I'm just like, this is the...
Okay, here's the theory.
Listen. It's quarantine. We're all picking up some real nutty hobbies.
Okay.
So Rudzinski and Kelvin were like, what if...
I think I figured this out,
though.
A
map we can't see with detergent on the blast door. Yes, go ahead.
So, you know how they use that thing to, like, hold the one door up?
Yeah.
Maybe it's because that door doesn't go all the way down that the light doesn't come on. But right. If you were to let that door go all the way down, you could see it.
Oh.
But they want the freedom to be able to move throughout the thing while the door is down so he can go, like, you know, get more detergent or have it be down for a long period of time.
So you could unhotwire it, too, and... Do you have to get back under that door to the computer room?
Well, yeah, because it only stays down for a couple of minutes while they're dry. Because that's for the drops, right? The food drops?
Follow-up question. Why not paint your crazy detergent map on, like, a wall?
Well, that's what they're doing.
But there's a wall that they could use. Why are they using the blaster? Anyway, I love the blaster map. It's such a fun reveal in lockdown. But listen, it makes no sense. And just like the detergent is just like the straw that breaks my back when I think about it. Whenever I think about it and I'm like, cause did you know that detergent shows up in like black light? I didn't. So like, how did Rudzinski know anyway?
Well, you know, he was a Renaissance man.
He was. He's some mysterious Renaissance man who killed himself with a shotgun and left a nice little brown splotch.
Although, even that, and this, we talked about this during the live watch with some folks. If I were Kelvin Inman and I had murdered Rudzinski, let's just say for this thought exercise.
In theory.
That would be the reason why I would not clean up the brown stain. Because otherwise, why the hell hasn't he, like, cleaned the ceiling? I would leave the brown stain there so that I could tell that story every time. Or I would have planted the brown stain there so that if someone ever showed up and was like, hey, where'd the other guy go? I would have some kind of story. Maybe I'm in need of help, yes.
I need to go to the Santa Rosa Institute.
But I was like, my first question was like, why is that still up there? Why didn't he clean that?
FYI, because he was using all of his detergent to make maps.
Right.
Detergent.
Yeah. Detergent economy. Not great.
Here's a fun fact about laundry detergent. It glows under UV lights because phosphors are added so that when your clothes are in sunlight, they appear brighter.
Hmm.
Oh.
Yeah. So it's all about the detergent companies trying to fool you into thinking your clothes are cleaner than they actually are.
Right. It doesn't work if you're in a hatch because you never go out in the sun. Or if you live in 2020.
I mean, I will say that like the use of detergent here is a tidy, like it helps me feel better about that washer and dryer that are in the hatch. I'm like, mm-hmm. Right, because they need a detergent for, you know, their blast door map. Anyway, speaking of things that they got off the palette, Dharma detergent is one of them, I'm sure. Let's discuss Desmond's drinking choices this episode, because it really perturbs me that he is drinking, like, hot, because it's hot on the beach,
mm-hmm.
White wine.
Oh, that's white wine?
Yes. Like vodka, rum, whatever, gin, fine, sure, but like hot Chardonnay, or it didn't look like Chardonnay bottle, it looked like a Sauvignon Blanc bottle to me. Hot Sauvignon Blanc, blah, blah. So.
I mean, at a certain point,
I guess
you just, whatever you can get.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's like, I'm going to take a nap. A drink is like sit on the beach, have some hot white wine.
Right. Before Kelvin went down to almost turn the key that one time, he was drinking a Merlot, I noticed.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay. So Kelvin's more of a late night red guy than a white on the beach.
So Desmond commits some involuntary manslaughter and Kelvin's out of the picture. And lo and behold,
in fairness, Kelvin was about to take off without him.
That's true. It does look like, I did say involuntary manslaughter because he is just frustrated wrestling and Kelvin takes a bad shot to the back of the head. But that is on the day in September in 2004 when our losties crashed on the island. This was the moment that the series confirmed that the date the pilot actually aired was the date that Oceanic Flight 815 went down. Cause Desmond sent it down with the button. Or by not pressing the button.
Right. With his lack of attention to the button.
Yeah. Cause did he bury Kelvin at all? Or do you think he just smashed it and was like, oh no, gotta run back?
I mean, maybe later. He was there for a while after Kelvin was dead.
Maybe the hurly birdie, Kelvin.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's why I always like when Kelvin's like, and I only had 108 minutes to bury him. I was like, yeah. What, you had to bury him like immediately in one shot? Yeah, yeah, like 108 minutes to go and like, dig the polar bears, Neil. Like, all right, bud, whatever you say.
So I think that's all our flashback, which brings us to our bountiful on-island conflict. Let's give the hatch a break for a second and talk about the otherness of it all. We pick up and Saeed has a counter plan now that he realizes that the boat is the element of surprise that he needed to sail around. And Jack is like, yeah, cool. I'm going to keep my cool with this plan. Even though Jack is I don't think comfortable with not calling the shots most of this episode.
You don't have to qualify it with this episode.
Well, Jack's never comfortable not calling the shots, but especially in this episode, after like two seasons of most people listening to Jack, he really screws up being unable to keep his cool. And then like kind of gives away to Michael that they know about him by like not loading his gun. It all seems weird.
Hey, do you guys remember the time that Jack looked at Kate and Sawyer and Hurley and was like, do you think I really would have brought you out here without a plan? And then they immediately get captured.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Classic also, yeah, Jack.
Of course I think you like immediately cut to Michael rolling up on the like on Yurtville. Like, uh-oh.
Yeah, no, it like cuts immediately to like Saeed like opening a non-hatch. That's why exactly. That one doesn't have a name.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
just the door to the hatch.
To nowhere. Yeah.
Ooh, actually, that's a very precise moment. Neil, would you like to skip down to the official Lost podcast check-in?
Sure.
And we could talk about this moment where they do talk about a plan. And Sawyer says, what plan? And we cut away. And it seems like some stuff is left unsaid.
Yeah.
You're Damon Lindelof?
Yes.
Excellent.
Okay. In character. Okay. Producer question. Why didn't Hurley attack Michael? This is a serious one, and I think we should talk about it. By Eggotown, why didn't Hurley attack Michael, or at least show signs of anger when Michael admitted that he murdered Libby? Is he really that much of a coward? Thanks. Love the podcasts.
You know, I think that that's kind of a legitimate question. I mean, I think that there were obviously a lot of like strong and deep conflicted emotions that all these characters had when it was revealed that Michael was a traitor and responsible for murdering Libby and Ana Lucia. But at that juncture in the storytelling, we just sort of felt as writers that they didn't have much choice. That basically when Jack presented the alternative going back basically was a more doom scenario, we thought that was enough. Maybe we should have spent a little bit more time dealing with the character's reaction to it. Given the choices, it felt like the character's best choice was to go forward at that point, that the emotional reaction on a deeper level to what Michael did had to be deferred.
And also, the reality is, we, watching the finale, we agree, you know, that is a legitimate point. And sometimes character motivation becomes a casualty of the process, especially in a rush job like the finale. Which is not to say that we don't plan things out in advance, but that's one of the things that becomes victim of the circumstance. And the reality, as I recall, is that there are versions of scenes and a much longer version of that scene, even at script, where we dealt with precisely that issue. In fact, Sawyer also wanted to turn around and say, at this point, it's stupid, forget about it. In the show, you look at it and In the end of the scene, Sawyer says, "What plan?" And for Jack to explain, you know, Saeed's going around the corner and doing this, that, and the other thing, we're like, the audience kind of already knows that. And unfortunately, we lost that whole page of, you know, them saying, Michael's a murderer. We don't want to have anything to do with him. And we needed them to continue anyway. So then it was a casualty of war, as it were. This is a case where Carlton and I literally come forward and say, this is a case where we had done it a little differently. The characters sort of deserve the opportunity to sort of explain their motivations better. And we wish we had done that.
End scene. So also they address another listener question on the official podcast that's like, great finale, guys. So do you not care about the monster anymore? And they're like, oh, we had an idea about what to do with the monster, but we could not fit that in season two. Because there's just so much to deal with here in the finale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the Hurley thing is tough, but in the end, you're seeing Hurley's a very empathetic character. So I feel like Hurley is the one that you can really sell with. We don't want everybody else to die, you know, whether that's a good idea or not. You know, I never really super questioned why Hurley didn't try to like take out Michael, because I think Hurley trusts Jack. And Sawyer probably trusts Kate. And Kate maybe trusts Jack enough to get everybody on board. But yeah, I mean, you can definitely see in the episode where that it all happens a little too quickly. And they never really sit back and think about what Michael did or...
Yeah, there's not a lot of time before. The episode's so built on... I guess allowing the audience the catharsis of the characters finally getting to hear the truth about Michael after we've sat with it for a few episodes, that you're like so pissed about Michael, and the episode, the entire season actually just kind of like leaves you there. Like, Michael wins. He kills two of the Losties, and then he gets his son back, and he gets a boat, and he gets the boat off the island.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to do some things that are, you know, despicable, obviously, to get there, but... because of the momentum of it and the holy shit moment of Henry coming back out onto the dock and, you know, Michael talking to him and that weird mysterious thing he says about never being able to get back to the island once you leave, it all seems like we're not going to have a chance for the Losties to deal with Michael's emotional arc. So I could see where that gap is in there. But again, this episode's so jam-packed full of weird stuff. I guess here's a question. Instead of this sort of abbreviated moment with Michael, would you be willing to sacrifice the Hurley Bird dive for an extra couple of minutes?
No chance. No. The Hurley Bird rules.
There's a lot that I'd be willing to sacrifice.
I mean,
for that emotional clarity.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think that there, when you look back at season two, there's probably fair enough. A fair amount of stuff that you would sacrifice to get more Michael's story anyway, you know?
Yeah.
He really, it's sort of a meta commentary by the finale that it's there's like, oh yeah, you thought we were going to answer questions about Michael? Nope. Now he's on a boat.
Bye. There's a lot of Charlie in this episode that I don't think we need at all.
Oh yeah. There's a lot of weird Charlie. Like, why are you acting like this, Charlie?
Yeah,
in this episode,
we said we wanted to talk about this. We can't. I mean, I guess we'll talk about it probably a little more in the storm. But like, that Charlie comes out at the end when there are three people that we are not checking in with that were down in that hatch, and he's just like being cute with Claire.
Mm-hmm.
And
he's not at all wondering like, why yeah. John and Echo aren't back yet and yeah. where Desmond went.
Yeah.
You want to hear the cool story about that fireball and not talk about the sky glowing violet or anything? Yeah, sure.
So weird.
There are other moments where it seems like he's acting weird. So like when he comes up on like, well, okay, we know he doesn't like Locke because you know, we've forgotten Dark Charlie, but apparently the episode for a brief moment remembers Dark Charlie, because he comes across crying Locke, and it's, like, taunting him. Which, yes, lines up with, like, Dark Charlie wanting Locke to, like, feel small, but also just feels weird in the middle of the episode, because Charlie, you know, is there to basically be Echo's sidekick for on the other side of the blast door. Yeah, I don't know. Most of the time Charlie has an emotional reaction and he's not running away from a fireball in this episode. I'm unsure what that emotional reaction is based on.
I mean, I will talk about it a little bit more a little later on, but like the Claire and Charlie moment like does work for me on and like gives me like peanut butter feelings. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like it's very
well, it's a sweet moment for Claire especially.
Well, I mean like
she's been through a lot this season.
If we really think about it, it's not because he like it's really still only been like 12 days since he stole her baby, true. Right? But if I forget about that and like pretend it's been like real time or whatever, it is very sweet and Emily DeRaven is so like cute and it's just like it's a very cute moment and makes me you know, I have to do a lot of mental gymnastics to get there, but when I get there, I'm like, they're so cute, Charlie and Claire. It's okay. You can like tear up my whatever.
What? My, like, oh, you're talking to the listeners, not like me and Neil.
No. Yeah, my like.
Fair. My your perspective?
My holding people accountability card or something like that.
I think Joanna's opinion was too loose, types man into iTunes review.
Tighten it up.
Is it kind of weird how much the actual beach survivors are just unaware of what's happening in this very important dramatic filled episode?
It's weird in this context as well, especially when Charlie and Echo are going to get the dynamite and Charlie very casually references what happened to Arst. So he's acting in a way that Echo definitely knows about the fact that Arst blew up. So in a camp where that story has already permeated everyone, including Echo, who came late to the party, I can't imagine. I don't understand how word isn't getting around about the fact that the hatch alarm keeps going off.
I mean, that's a corner that they've just written themselves into all the time. Because, mm-hmm. like, all of our main characters, except for Charlie and Claire, I mean, like, all of our main characters are so far off the beach that for the reaction shot to the quarantine door, you had to go to Claire and Bernard.
Right.
That's who's left.
Oh, shit. These are the only ones we have left for this.
Yes, it's Claire and Bernard and the baby. You know, so, but, like, yes, all the, like, quote-unquote leaders are gone, but, like, why wouldn't the beach people be, like, having a big meeting right now about everything that just happened.
Right, big meeting over by the galley.
Can we talk about how, like, all the A-team left without telling anybody?
And then the sky turned purple, and then you left Scott to clean up the pantry. Scott, right? He's the one who's still alive?
Sure.
Steve cleaning up the pantry mess? Ugh. Guys, anyway, it's just, but that's the problem, a problem of Lost. I mean, I'm not mad about it, but it's just sort of like they have all these extras to like make it believable that there's like a large group of survivors, but it doesn't really work because the only people who are ever involved in anything are our main Losties, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently the Bernard Claire scene was supposed to be a Bernard Rose scene, but the actress was on guest starring on another TV show, so she wasn't around for those 17 days they were actually filming the episode. So there's Claire.
I did have questions as to why Bernard wasn't at Bernard and Rose weren't at the funeral for Ana Lucia and Libby.
Oh man,
like Bernard knew Libby and Ana Lucia very well, you know, like. Where were they? Not being paid for that day of work. Okay.
Not being paid for that episode.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is another good episode for Daniel Dae Kim getting paid for a couple of, you know, great expressions and maybe two lines. But I'm looking forward to some Jin resurgence in season 3 because he's been safe with Sun for too long. But now, as far as we know, we'll leave him and Saeed and Sun somewhere on the north side of the island in an abandoned Yurtville. We learn that the rectangle hatch is fake.
No.
So
it was just a hatch.
Just a hatch. Just a just some doors on a wall. They really were pretending like Walt had suggested. But that being said, we don't really get any other answers about the others. There's the illusion we get the answers about the others because we get Bearded Man's name. Because
they all stand on a dock together.
They all stand on a dock together calling each other by their first names. Well, two of them do. Tom and B. Clue, who we point out in the storm, but welcome call me. B. A. Clue is the name of that character. And yeah, we kind of leave everybody on a cliffhanger.
No, no. Okay, we learned some other things, right? We learned Desmond uses the word hostiles. This is the first time we've heard that word.
Yes,
around the others.
Desmond and Kelvin, I think.
We get this idea of like a compass bearing that Michael has to follow.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like Desmond tried to leave the island and couldn't, despite being presumably an okay sailor. And couldn't leave the island, and so he's like, this is all there is. Whereas, quote-unquote, Henry Gale gives Michael a, like, very specific compass bearing to aim towards.
Bearing 3, 2, 5.
That's interesting. And then they talk about going home. So, like, we're like, okay, what's home? What's home for the others? You know what I mean?
Yes.
These folks are going home with us, so.
I don't know if those are answers, but yes, those are other things we learn.
Those are promises.
What is things we learn versus answers? What's the difference?
Your phone was fake. I feel like that's an answer.
Well, I guess. Okay, so I'm trying to think about this if I were watching it for the first time. I guess it's not necessarily clear if Yurtville is fake or if they just took all of the others over to the other side of the island.
Hmm.
But I will say this, there are too many others. There are more others at the end, I feel. That it just feels like there's too many others for them to live in. You keep calling it Yurtville. I wanted to call it a yurt cul-de-sac. It's like three tents, man. There's like nothing going on up there.
I have to say, I love Kate with her mouth bound being like, I know your beard's fake, bitch. You bitch. I know it's a fake beard. I always love whenever Tom uses one of their names. I don't know what it is, but I'm seeing it in the way he does it. He's like, thank you, Kate. My beard was uncomfortable. He's like, it's the same as when he says John's name, Jack's name. It's just like, blah, blah, blah. And then
he's
like,
he's just so friendly.
And then the interplay between him and Clue. And then, quote unquote, Henry Gale being like, where's your beard?
That's how you really know that he's management. He's a so real funny. Migrant. He's like, man, beard.
Where's the beard?
Where's your beard? And like, also the way that Michael Emerson, so like, oh, that like, oh, Henry Gale, this messy bitch who loves drama, rolls up on a boat and like walks out.
No shoes on.
And then just gives Jack this like weird look and nod and then just says like hello again. And so you're Michael Emerson and you're at home and you get your script and it just says hello again and he's like I'm gonna make a whole meal out of this.
Yeah. you guys think you've seen all the Michael Emerson faces, but there are 50 more faces.
There's so many faces. Henry Gale, what a guy.
Henry, yeah. What a guy. He seems
extremely creepy.
He does say, I mean, I don't know if this is an answer, but he does say like something along the lines of, we got more than we bargained for with Walt. So that's just further like, what the heck is wrong with Walt?
Yeah, got more than we bargained for with Walt. We're the good guys, I think, is also
we're the good guys.
That's fucking weird.
Line. And the idea that they got more than they bargained for with Walt, but they're also letting Walt go.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, that's a whole nother level of questions.
There's also like a purpose. I mean, this kind of goes to the very end of the season, but there's, we're back to another list, and it's a list of like our three main characters now, and they've got them for who knows what reason. And the interesting thing is he said he was going there to get Locke, and Locke is not one of the ones that they absolutely need by the end of this season. So a whole bunch of other questions. I think at the end of each season, I'm going to say, with the end of each season, yeah, I'm going to say this. With the end of each season, you have a weird idea of what the others are, and there are more questions. And then finally, like by the end of the show, I think we'll be able to settle on an idea of what the others are. Maybe, maybe listen to the storm if you want to hear more debate about what the others are. But I love the swirling mystery of it. And I think it's another thing where here in the end of season 2, much like the Widmores, it's so tiny, and like Joanna was saying, hinges entirely on the performances just being excellent. Because there's not a ton of actual substance there, frustratingly, for us.
Yeah. Imagine right. having to wait a whole,
know.
You know,
I don't know that I'm whatever not frustrated. Months.
You're not frustrated?
No.
Well, if the whole idea of Lost is that it's always presenting you with new mysteries, this one ends with several huge mysteries.
But that's exciting. That are Isn't
yeah,
it exciting to have
I
mysteries?
Think
to
have I will say this.
A whole summer to like debate what the foot of that statue is?
Some people are going to be glad that they can watch it next week with the podcast.
That's true. I do miss the like summer hiatus where you just sort of like go.
Here's our information. Know. It's mm-hmm. time to go over uh-huh. it as many ways as possible.
Yeah. I mean, Lost was the ultimate version of
Do
that
we
show,
know
I
for
think.
Sure that Aaron isn't Hurley back in time and Hurley's just a grown up baby? We don't know for sure. That was a real theory in 2006. All right. Let's go back to the hatch and wrap up some stuff there. John Locke having a bad day at the beginning, or I guess a bad first 2 days. If this episode takes place over 3 days, super depressed about what he found out at the Pearl and, is unable to go on the quest, with Jack. So he doesn't, learn that the button's real until it's far too late. And they kind of build in a conflict, by having, Locke and Desmond lock out Echo. Which is fine and exciting because he gets to use the dynamite, but really just a good excuse to have a couple of Locke and Desmond scenes with them, the two up before Echo, the two most famous button pushers on the show, get to hash it out. I like this, but Locke frustrates me. On this rewatch more than the previous one, because it sort of feels like the way he presents his problem is like, I thought this was all like I had a purpose and I thought this was all it was all coincidence and tricks. It wasn't fate and purpose, which seems interesting, but it also seems like a, low consequence experiment as to when you let the button run out. Like if, there was Echo with his big Bible stick who wants to press the button. I feel like if I were John Locke, even if I was super frustrated, I'd be more the crying in the jungle John Locke and less the, oh, I'll smash the computer and show this guy how wrong he is. No?
Remember when Locke was crying in the jungle?
He was crying in the jungle.
I mean, he's really the discovering the Pearl. He really sort of started down a hill, a slippery slope, if you will, toward completely losing his faith. And that's the culmination of that, I think, is using the Jesus stick to kill the computer.
An element that I really liked in this episode is that when he's talking about, like, you know, my whole pathetic life, like, everything's been, like, bullshit and blah, blah, and then he says, and he talks about Boone.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, a kid died because I thought I was right.
I feel bad about the gooping.
I feel really bummed about that. I'm definitely right now, though.
Yeah, exactly.
I was wrong about that, but I'm definitely right now, though. And then you know, you get the classic, I was wrong. Anyway.
Well, see, that's the thing. It's like, Locke's not good with lies. He's like the anti-Saeed. Locke, like, falls for it because he wants to believe so bad.
Yes.
That he will just, he'll just take, you could take his kidney.
That
you could sneak out of the house.
Character. Yes, Dave.
Yeah, no, I don't like it.
I do, because there's plenty of people out there like that. Mm-hmm. Where you're just so, like, thirsty for something to believe in, you know, that you fall for anything.
It's believable as a real character thing, especially that we're in our 60s days on the Miracle Island where he could walk and the island seems to have control over how good his leg feels. But as somebody who is rewatching it and would like to like the person that I'm watching, it's frustrating to me. I would like Locke to be more likable. I'd like Jack to be more likable. There's a lot of the characters that would like to be more likable.
Do you feel for Locke?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, especially because this is a rewatch, I feel, for Locke. And so maybe, like I said before, I thought the button was a lie the first time, so I probably was more on Locke's side, obviously, there. But now, especially on a rewatch, knowing how the episode ends, I'm like, man, you are really forcing this topic. Like, if I was like, Neil, you can't eat chunky peanut butter. Creamy peanut butter is the better peanut butter. And Neil's like, all right. And then I insist he make a sandwich, and when he starts making it with the wrong type of peanut butter, I like bat it down out of his hands. I'm like, no, Neil, never the wrong peanut butter. It's just like, seriously.
That's how you lose a hand, bud.
Yeah, like, let Neil have his peanut butter. Let Echo press the button. You got to press the button, and Jack kind of let you did it for as long as you wanted to. Let Echo press the button.
Yeah, it's the timing thing is a little funny with Locke. But then again, I mean, it's a TV show, so they needed the timing to work for the end of the season. Also, there's the element of, like, when the cat's away, when Jack, right, and when Jack and all the guns run off to the other side of the island, there's nothing. There's absolutely nothing to stop Locke from doing this other than Echo, and that doesn't work so well. Yeah, I mean, it's just the John Locke thing is really fascinating. And I think one of the things I really like about that whole sequence is that in true Lost fashion, they not only are giving you like the culmination of Locke's emotional journey from the back half of the season, but they also stick that little detail in there where Desmond's like, I think I crashed your plane. And then they don't really say a whole lot else about it. And it's like, holy shit. Here's another mystery inside of our rapidly unfolding John Locke mystery. It's just,
yeah, and everybody who knows blows up.
It's a wonderful little trick. Charlie? Yeah, I mean, it's a wonderful little trick there, because you're really, really, really invested in finding out if John Locke's right. Just like John Locke is very invested in figuring out if he's right, which I think is his ultimate, like the ultimate impetus for this is just like he just needs to know if he's right, and sort of rushes into, you know, maybe blowing up the hatch. I'm not sure. It's not clear what happened there. so but I love that it's like added. You stick a new one in there somewhere. You know.
Yeah. What Kelvin sort of explains, and up till now we haven't had any better information. So what we're assuming is, whatever the incident was, there's suddenly this pocket of unique electromagnetic energy. That's an answer. Yeah, there's under the Swan Station, mm-hmm. and every 108 minutes, there's like a buildup, like a pressure buildup, and it needs to be safely released. And as we learn with Desmond's first crashing of the plane, you can get to system failure level and not have a full-on, implosion, explosion, white sky, whatnot. But it will cause some sort of crazy disturbance. Okay, jumping a little bit ahead, but Desmond puts in the key, turns the thing. Then we switch to Antarctica, where there's an electromagnetic incident, and one of the guys said, "Did we miss it again?" That's the plane, right? The plane going down? That would be the other electromagnetic incident that they missed?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Yeah, so I guess the idea with those guys at the end is that they've been trying to find... They've been tracking certain anomalies to try and figure out where, you know, where Desmond went, I guess. And
I don't know if you heard her when she said it, but Penelope Woodmore has a lot of money.
Right. Yeah.
I'm just trying to make a rules for the hatch. Is this like anytime that counter hits zero, enough electromagnetism is released to make the island visible somehow on some sort of electro,
or to make it like vibrate? It looks like the island is vibrating.
It's like tremors.
It does look it. Yeah, it's like a tremor. Yeah, yeah. It's mm-hmm. worms.
And that is ground. Even if it was just like even if you were to science it out and be like, oh, it's just like an earthquake, then you'd still be able to detect that elsewhere in the world, right?
Yeah, I think
like that would still show up in some research station as like a geological anomaly. So,
yeah, yes. I mean, if you were looking for it, but that is, like Joanna was pointing out with the direct boat heading, Desmond can't seem to get out of the island. There seems to be like one very specific way to get off, but that you can't get back because apparently it's hidden. And the way to sort of not make it, or make it, you know, at least momentarily visible, because if you can miss it, that means it may not be happening consistently, at least until you turn the screw or turn the key and blow up the whole thing. I'm just trying to figure out what our current rules are of when we can see the island and when we can't. But maybe that comes up later. Maybe I don't need to know all the rules right now. All right, Hatch blows up with a cool fire effect. Then Desmond, turns the key. And we're left in question mark land after a whole bunch of shots of everybody all around the island looking up at like a purple whitish sky and having some vibrating and some very cool sound effects where everybody's holding their head like it's really loud and ear piercing, but the sound effect is actually kind of more of a hum. Mm-hmm. I like it. Mm-hmm. Even though it's bad sci-fi and not good prestige drama, I like that sort of thing a lot. And I think that brings us up to the end. I'm sure I missed a ton of stuff, but is there anything that we absolutely need to talk about before we head to our corners?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't end with them looking up at the sky, right? It ends with them, like, at night, because that Charlie and Claire stuff is...
It does on the sky, and I guess the other where it ends for our North Beach Island people is Hurley has to go back and tell everybody, which is apparently his point on the list, was to be the person who goes back and tells anybody his friends aren't coming back, and then Jack and Kate share like some angry eyes.
Yeah, well, no, it ends with those amazing reaction shots as they're getting the bags put over their heads. I just, mm-hmm. That's one of the most visceral memories I had from like the original Watch of Lost. It's like watching that moment and then being like, wait, shit, I have to wait how long for the next one?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Where are they going? Jack's so mad. How is he going to stay mad off the off season? Who knows?
So you're so handsome. What's
so
happening?
You're so handsome.
They're taking our top tier thruple.
I was watching some clips of Caesar 1 Sawyer hair, and I'm so glad that we survived that and are in good Sawyer hair. Yeah. Finally. All right, let's do some corners. Neo, we got some Giacchino this week.
Oh, Giacchino went off for this finale, by the way. There are 6 musical cues in this. Hold on, I'll find them.
Reminder, this episode was written 4 weeks before it aired and shot over 17 days.
Right. So these are the... I'm just going to read the titles. They're great. One of them is called Toxic Avenger. The other one is called I Crashed Your Plane, Brother. There's one called Echo Blaster, which is pretty funny. Another one called The Hunt, which is the action theme in the episode and is... you'll hear it a bunch of times. McGale's Navy, which plays toward the end of the episode, which I believe is in reference to quote-unquote Henry Gale and his crew.
His boat.
McGale's with a G.
Yeah, but a McHale's Navy joke. That's timeless.
Right? Like, I feel like maybe this is when Giacchino sort of entered his prime. And then Bon Voyage Traitor is it the other
Michael. Oh, we haven't talked about... Okay, this is something we need to talk about, sorry, in the corners, which is this. Mm-hmm. Okay, we've talked all season a bit about how, like, the issue with Walt is that Malcolm David Kelly, the actor who played him, was too tall. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite things about this is they're like, here, scrunched out in this...
Yeah. Yeah. Sit down underneath Walt? This countertop.
He's in the boat. Where in the boat? It's like a one thing. But, he's just been looking at the wall.
We can't have
there?
Him on the dock. He's too
he's
tall.
He's too tall for the dock.
He's got to stay where he could kneel down and say, Dad.
That's so funny. All
right. Jungle of Mystery Moments. There's a statue with 4 toes.
Foot?
Foot. that's Saeed, Sud, and Jinsi. Andor is the bird that says Hurley's name.
Yeah. I mean, I thought about for a while the I Crashed Your Plane is up there. the as if we were to pick dialogue for this, and then the one, the line that Henry gives about Walt, like, we got more than we bargained for and we took Walt, is like so mysterious and so weird. But yeah, that that foot, just what the, why is there a four-toed foot statue?
Where's the rest of the statue? Mm-hmm. How long has anything been on this island? I don't get it. The Boone Carlisle Memorial Falling Down Award goes to the hatch door. She takes a big tumble after lying.
It fell the furthest.
Yeah. It gets blown up twice in both season finales. Go hatch door.
Can't wait to see where it ends up in season three.
It really, if there was like a Dr. Arntz blowing up award, the hatch just cinched it from Arntz.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Joanna, I see we have two listings for Accent Corner.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about the Widmores. Mm-hmm. And
they are, in the show context, British, right?
Yeah, that's what I was trying to. So they are British.
Desmond Scottish.
Henry Ian Cusick does not have that accent in real life, but he, like,
as you know from the time he was on this podcast.
Yeah, but he, his, like, family's Scottish, so he is Scottish, but, like, it's a good accent, it's just not his accent, as opposed to, like, Peter Dinklage's accent, which is a bad accent and also not his accent. So, Sonia Walger, I think it's, is it Walger or Walger? I'm not sure.
Not sure,
but the,
either.
The lovely Sonia Walger, her of the great hair, who plays Penny, is she actually British? Neil?
I think it's yes for both of these. Like, I'm almost 100% sure Alan Dale is British as well. They're both British.
Okay. We're gonna go one by one.
Okay, sorry. Sonia Walger, British.
Sonia, British. Dave?
I'm also gonna say British, but just like, by facial construction. I'm gonna say that's an Anglo-European.
Yeah. That's fair. Yes, she is, well, for some reason she's listed on, Wikipedia as British American, but I can't find, like, she was educated, she grew up in England, it is, appears, so I don't know why
she's, maybe she, like, lives
American.
In LA now?
Maybe. She's conversational in French and fluent in Spanish, and her father is Argentinian, so that's fun.
Ooh.
To know.
Mm.
But, she's a British-American actress. All right, so Neil already gave his answer for Alan Dale.
Yeah.
Dave, do you know where Alan Dale is from?
I'm gonna say he's not British, to contrast with Neil. He's just some dude named Alan. And they, like, did community theater for a few years, and someone was like, you want to do television? And he ended up being awesome at it.
All right. So, no, Alan Dale is, like, extremely famously, New Zealand, from New Zealand. He moved to Australia. He was on.
Oh, that actually makes a lot of sense now.
He was on Neighbours, which is the, like, famous Australian soap opera. From 1985 to 1993.
Did he do community theater before then?
Possibly.
Okay, so I got everything except the country of origin, right? Let's pretend.
Okay, which is the literal question we're asking here. He's very well known for TV lovers. He was Caleb Nichol on The OC, of course. He was Bradford Mead on Ugly Betty, of course. He's just like, if you want... a super bad guy.
If you want a character that is going to play a father that would never make a fart joke, hire Alan Dale.
Call Alan Dale. Was he a bad guy on 24?
Probably. Anybody a good guy on 24?
He played Vice President Jim Prescott. I didn't watch 24, so I don't know if he was a bad guy on 24. But he was on it, like, every show. Name a show he was on it. You know what I mean? So that's Alan Dale. So he played the Australian ambassador on Flight of the Conchords. That's beautiful. I need to watch that.
That's where I've seen him.
Oh, oh really? My God. Yes, God. That is him.
And now I feel really dumb for guessing that he was British, because I've 100% seen that Flight of the Conchords episode about 1,000 times.
So there we go. Alan Dale, the great Alan Dale.
Alan Dale. I bet we never see him again on this show.
That's it. One
is that
done.
The first time that someone who is really Australian? No, he's from New Zealand.
Yeah.
That's different.
Yeah. It is. But
someone who is really from Australia or New Zealand playing someone of a different accent instead of the other way around on Lost.
those are the Whitmores.
The Whitmores. Wow. The Henry Gay Memorial, obviously a lie war. It just goes to everything Kelvin says. Don't believe any of it.
Listen, this guy is over here.
Kill himself? Who knows? Is there a quarantine? Yeah, probably not. Hostels? Yeah, I mean there are hostels, but we've never heard him called that before. It's all a lie.
If John Locke really had not seen the glowy blast door, I would not have believed that it existed.
I was going to say, is he really adding to the map, or is he just like putting soap on a wall where Rudzinski made a full map before him? I don't know.
He's the one who's doing all those quote-unquote tunnels that look all weird, and they're just not, they're squiggly lines.
Is that his real beard? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Did he actually join the Dharma Initiative, or did he just find the jumpsuits?
Does he have a twin brother who was serving in Iraq around the same time?
I don't know.
We don't know.
Dave pointed out, I feel like when we were doing the live watch, like when Desmond destroys the hatch, like throws all the books and the vinyl on the ground, and then Dave's like, and now he has however long to clean it up before everyone else gets down there.
Yeah, before Kate belays down.
Yeah.
they all come in. Excellent. It's time for everyone's favorite segment. It's the jungle of Kistery. Who should have kissed in Lost on the island? This doesn't have to be two people. This doesn't even have to be two things. Let's check it out. I'm going to go first this time. I'm going to go first because I'm finally picking a throuple. Going throuple. Neil's usually throupling up. And, but
you've
my
crossed over the dark side. I'm proud of you.
Yep. This is going to be the throuple that runs away with all of it. I'm saying Saeed, Sun, and Jin, pre-pregnancy vomiting, but all on boat.
I believe in the Slack.
Morning prayers.
I believe in the Slack. Somebody dropped an L boat sex from Game of Thrones days, and everybody was like, "Yeah."
Joanna, who needs to kiss?
One of our listeners, Phil, dropped in. I mean, you think you're going to run away with the thruple, but I don't know because Phil dropped Desmond and Penny in here.
Go
so.
To. It wouldn't make sense for them to kiss outside the Tour de Stade.
It's distressing to me that Phil has already figured it out.
Yeah.
You could just keep nominating Desmond and Penny and probably win.
You could just do Desmond and Penny every week.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
This is the beginning of the end of Jungle of History is when Desmond and Penny are introduced.
I picked Charlie and Claire. I know. You just stole her baby. You can cancel me if you want to, but I just find that moment at the end very cute.
He did give the baby
really
back.
Neil's like, let me be clear. He returned the baby.
Yeah. I mean, stole makes it sound like he kept it. He borrowed.
Oh, like a library book.
Yeah.
Okay. Neil, who is in
file that one under AA. My Jungle of Kistery this week is Echo and Locke, but at a very specific time. Right there at the end, right after John says, I was wrong, I want Echo to walk over and be like, no, it was all right, and then just make out.
Oh.
You know, and as the hatch explodes around them or whatever.
Yeah, for whatever reason, that shot in my mind of Locke and Echo kissing as the hatch explodes around them, the first thing that jumped to my mind was the Stargate score. Would have been great.
Sorry, they used in so many trailers, film trailers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's good score. Book club this week, very important. Our mutual friend plays a key role.
Always check your prison book for a letter.
I think that's the lesson of book club is like, don't rubber band close your book that might like shake out your books. I guess that would be a good rule for that. Anything in that hatch, the end of this episode,
shake out the book,
which is like, you should go through and shake out the books and see what's in there. Cause there's gotta be something.
Pull all the vinyl out.
Yeah.
So we know of, you know, we haven't seen a lot of reading go down in the hatch, but we do know that two things that weren't read in the hatch were Turn of the Screw, because it's hollowed out, and our mutual friend, because it has a very important letter in it, which he still doesn't read it, but, you know, has to turn the key.
He read it. What?
He read it?
No, he read it the night that John was pounding on the hatch.
Yeah.
Oh, when he read the letter. You think he read the whole
book?
Oh,
sorry,
the book.
I thought you read it. No.
I mean, maybe he did, like...
Well, he cleaned up the hatch, and then he spent the next, I don't know, day or two reading the book.
Waiting for them to hike all the way to the Black Rock.
Yeah.
Blow up Arnst. Where's Libby? Our new segment about where Libby is. Once again, though, Libby's actually in the flashback.
They keep putting her in the damn flashback.
Yeah. So let's say, where's Libby? Neil says her spirit is part of the boat now.
Yeah.
So we have current Libby, too.
I like to think of it similar to, spoiler alert for Solo, it's similar to what happens with the Millennium Falcon in that movie. Libby is now part of the boat.
Yeah. She's part of the boat's hyperdrive.
Yeah.
All right, guys.
Elizabeth. That's me. You might know me as Libby. Libby short for Elizabeth. It's a lesser known shortening of Elizabeth. It's me. I'm Elizabeth.
It's me. And then another boat called Betts comes along, and it says it's Libby. And then it's Cars 4. Betts and Elizabeth find the mysterious island.
File that one under.
It's the three ships of what's his name? Christopher Columbus. The Elizabeth, the Libby, and the Lizzie.
Yeah. And the Lizzie.
And the Lizzie Maria.
And the Eliza.
All right. I think that's going to do it for our calm section, so we will be headed into the storm right after this.
Have you ever been watching a movie that was based on a true story and wondered, well, how much of that is actually true? Like, did the CIA and Argo really expect them to escape on bicycles?
Did Joe Pesci's character in Goodfellas really have that much of a hair trigger?
Did only five people carry out all the assassinations in Munich?
I'm David Chen.
And I'm Joanna Robinson.
And we love movies.
But we also like facts.
And we talk about both of those things on Truth vs. Hollywood, a new podcast from Audio Boom.
We talk about films that were based on a true story and break down what really happened. But it's not just us reading Wikipedia. We'll hear from experts, journalists, and people who are really there to find out what Hollywood added in, like Mark Zuckerberg's entire reason for creating Facebook and the social network.
Or Ben Affleck's marriage problems in Argo.
And what they left out, like Mark Zuckerberg's entire wife in the social network.
Or all the heist scenes in Goodfellas. Truth vs. Hollywood launches June 12th.
Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your favorite shows.
It's not just the real facts, Joanna Robinson. It's the real facts. That's R-E-E-L.
Hi-yo. All right, now is the time on this podcast where we love to throw our thanks to our Patreon subscribers, small council level. These are the folks that keep the lights on. So we want to thank some newcomers, Christopher Woodside, Jeremy Jergens, Natalie Smith, also Ruby Durham, Tanya Shrum, Dennis Ramirez, Rebels, Alyssa Scott, Kwang Yu Yu, Liz Major, Brian Morowski, Randy Blash, Brittany Whimsy Riot, Sam Cohen, Kate Whitney, Amber Vickers, Jose Madali, Patricia Delaney, Tim Wiseman, and Carrie King. Someday I'll get Jose Madali correct.
Someday one of us will, because I've taken some swings. Thank you so much, person, for being a small council subscriber. Joseph? We're trying really hard.
Joseph. Is it like Joseph? Okay.
Sure. I don't want to speak for that person. All right. I would like to thank Lauren Bree, Christopher Bates, Steph Deal, Aubrey Ayer, Elise Abschutz, Josh Brown, Victoria Stout, Kathy Schauberg, Lindsay Romaine, Grace Brown, A. Will, Ellen Rabin, Katie Touchon, it is French, Liz Roller, Rosie O, Billy Bosky, James Cooper, John Lillystrom, Callum Guy, and Kitsune Lane. All one word.
Kneeling?
Kitsune, say it again.
I don't know, Kitsune Lane? Like, Elaine Kits, I don't know.
Kitsune Lane is how I see it spelled.
I see, yeah.
Yeah, close enough. All right, guys, guess what? I've got a list of folks that I would also like to thank. And it includes Samantha O'Leary, Monica Kay, Kevin Costello, Ian Spiegelblum, Patrick Kelly, Patrick McCracken, Angela Travis, C.A. Sachs, Kurt Klein, Vanessa Marshall, Corey Hilsey, Kelly Grady, Fanny Martin, Patrick Sullivan, Zachary Silverman, Grace Richardson, Joshua Lane, Bethany Townsend, Danielle, and Justin Young. Thank you all for being members of the Small Council.
This is it, guys. It's the final Ben storm.
Oh, Ben, 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 Ben.
Aw, Benry.
Ben. The last Ben.
But not only the last storm before we could say Ben, but the triumphant return of John Locke, antagonist check-in. Woo woo!
All right, let me read an email that pertains to this, if that's okay with you.
Yes, let's.
Okay. This is from Rachel. I loved reading all the comments in the finale. Watch thread. Lost finales are something special, especially when at the time we had to wait months to find out what the fuck just happened. I remember screaming at the TV many times. The season 2 finale has one moment that has always stuck out to me when John realizes that his idea to stop pushing the button because it's not real was 100% wrong. He looks so beaten down, so pathetic when he looks at Echo and he says, "I was wrong." But the thing is, John is always wrong. He trusted his father so much he donated a kidney. Wrong. He trusted Helen. He lost Helen trusting his father. Wrong. He trusted Eddie, who turned out to be I forgot about the Eddie episode. An undercover cop. Wrong. He got pushed out a window trusting his father. Wrong. He was so sure he had to open the hatch he inadvertently caused Boone's death. Wrong. He trusted Ben way too many times. Wrong, wrong, wrong. Why was John never able to learn from his mistakes? He traded one fervent belief for another until he was so beaten down when he could not convince any of the Oceanic Six to return. And we know how that ends. This moment in the season 2 finale has always stuck with me as the true nature of John Locke. A man who so desperately wants to believe he is special, that he has purpose, but in the end, he is always wrong. My rewatch last year, I felt such pity for John and wondered if he ever did find his purpose in life. I think his desire to trust was ultimately his downfall. And then she says some nice things. So, namaste, Rachel. So,
nice things about us or nice things about John Locke?
About
you could skip both of them. I just want to know.
About us.
Oh, okay.
And then really quickly, this is from Zach. And Zach says, I have a contribution to the Locke antagonist check-in, kinda. I first watched Lost using the complete DVD set a family friend owned. I was in my junior year of high school at the time, 2014. My first exposure to Lost, oh my god. Zach, you're young. My first exposure to Lost ever was walking into the living room multiple times while my parents were watching it live. My memories of this mean I knew John Locke was a villain because I had seen him be the bad guy in the final season. So I began Lost kind of mad that I had this part spoiled for me, but everything else is so great I didn't mind too much. Of course, I then began to fall more and more in love with Locke and his ability to keep pushing himself with a nearly unbreakable faith, as long as he had something to put that faith in. His death, the Jeremy Bentham reveal, still feels so tragic to me. John Locke is one of my favorite characters ever and most definitely is not a villain on Lost. And my question, and then Zach has a prompt for us, which I will save till after you talk about John Locke right now, Dave.
Yeah, okay. I assumed it was me, but I was going to start talking anyway. Yes! So here I do think there is a meaningful grappling with the thing I said in the column, which is like he just jumps from belief to belief and just cannot tolerate lies, and it's frustrating to the point where I think he is by necessity an antagonist in this episode, just so we can draw this conclusion out of Desmond and Echo sort of like respectively. He needs to be the counterpoint to those two things. And I think that also setting him up as the counterpoint is why Charlie is the one who finds him crying, is because you needed to find somebody who wasn't going to give John Locke an inch in that moment. And really the only person who was left on the beach in terms of that the writers could work with was Charlie. Cause I think anybody else might have taken a little bit more sympathetic attack towards it, but you really need to keep him in the antagonist position, if not a villain position. But if I remember much of anything about season three, we are coming up on prime Islock the antagonist debate season, because this is pre-Bentham, and he's like blowing up submarines, and he's like throwing knives into people's back. So
yeah, but Naomi was working for Widmore, so, you know.
So is Faraday, technically. We don't, like, I'm just saying he's making all these calls on faith. And then even worse, in season three, he's making all these calls based on faith after being so devastatingly wrong that he actually says it. Like, he acknowledges he's wrong, which is, I think, the difference between what Zach, I think, brought up, or maybe Rachel, whoever brought up all the instances, like, every time we see John Locke get, like, hoodwinked is because he's, like, put his trust in the wrong thing. Very rare, like, a lot of the times the audience realizes it, and that's sort of like the tragedy of it. But this episode is when he realizes it, and it doesn't change his behavior. He realizes it, and he talks about Boone, and it still doesn't change his behavior. He blows up Desmond and the hatch, and he still doesn't change his behavior. He doubles down, which makes him, if not an antagonist, at least dangerous for season three, which, puts you close to the antagonist line. I'm very happy to bring back this segment because season two kind of put John in the hatch, pressing the button. And they talk about it. There was another official, Lost podcast that came in between, the end of the season one and the beginning of season three. They live broadcast, their Comic-Con panel at Comic-Con 2006. And they did mention that, you know, sometimes, Locke, or Terry O'Quinn was frustrated, by his button pushing storyline in season two, and he wanted to, you know, return a little bit more to, hunting, tracking, Locke, and, they revealed at Comic-Con 2006 that Locke survived, and there would be more, badass Locke in season three. So that's where we got left off in real time with Locke antagonist chicken. I'm not going to give up the ghost.
Yeah. I mean,
I was wrong. Okay, what?
It's Locke's need for, yeah, Locke's need to find meaning, to find faith. And what I think is interesting about this finale is that all the men of science are also wrong. So the man of faith is super wrong. Like, he was way off. But then there is enough sort of unexplainable mystery about the island, especially now, that, you know, Jack's super wrong at the end too. Like, Jack thought he had a good plan. Saeed thought they had a good plan. They thought they had the others figured out, and clearly they don't. So I kind of like that the season two ends with this hopeful story of Desmond. Like, we meet Desmond, we meet Penny, we get this little kicker at the end where it's like, oh my God, Penny's our person on the outside now to root for. But all of our main characters, really, like, all the characters that, you know, the people on the beach should be talking about at the moment, sort of have a bad time. You know, everybody's wrong or captured or, exploded or imploded or, you know, season two's a lot of failure at the end there.
A lot of high stakes. I'll start this off very specifically, but we learned last week that sometimes people who are watching Lost for the first time listen to The Storm. So I thought it'd be interesting to, like, go through some of the things that you guys think were mysteries put up in this episode that actually have meaningful solutions by the time the show is over.
Oh, God.
So, for instance, Hurley Bird does not. I don't think Hurley Bird comes back, period.
There's a... Oh, it's like, I was watching some special feature, some, like, either.
Yes, it is in the complete series. Blu-ray had a bunch of special features, one of which had, yeah, Dr. Pierre Chang or whatever explain the genetic Hurley,
yeah,
birds.
Yeah.
But in terms of, like, things in the series, like, correct, Penny is gonna pay off big time. She's, gonna be, like, one of the main characters. Ben, obviously, you guys know all that stuff's gonna pay off. But stuff like the Hurley Bird is out. Libby and the boat is out for the rest of the show. Joanna, since you've been through the show more recently than I have, where do you put, Kelvin's time in the hatch on the scale of explained adequately, since we do get to, you know, like, meet Rosinski, but never see him with Kelvin, or too much mystery that they never got to loop back to.
I think it's fine. Like he served his purpose. Rudzinski is really interesting to me. Like, the fact that Rudzinski ended up in the hatch after, like, I mean, Rudzinski is a character. You know how there's, like, characters you love to hate? And mm-hmm. there's characters who you just fucking hate? That's how I feel about Rudzinski.
So it's like Mikhail versus Rudzinski?
It's just, I can't stand him. And he's all over the place, in season 5. Anyway, the fact that he winds, I'm gonna stop short by saying, I'll say I'm glad he's dead. I'm glad he's dead. That guy was the worst. doesn't really answer your question, but, you know. I mean, the fact that, like, Saeed knew this guy and then he was in the hatch with Desmond, like, that doesn't wind up mattering really at all, so.
Right.
I don't know. It's fine.
So Neil, sort of on that same line, if you were talking to somebody who hadn't seen the show before and they were very excited about that foot, what sort of landing pad do you put under them for the letdown?
I mean, the foot will come back, right? The foot statue? Yes. It comes back.
Yeah, I mean, it's as a location.
I don't know. I mean, I think that this is, you know, this is where they start to build out some of the other, like, symbolism that they're going to use. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know. What happens to that statue? I don't remember what happens to that statue.
So Richard's ship,
the Black
is
Rock,
the Black Rock hit it, and that's what broke it.
Okay.
And now Jacob lives in the foot of it, and sort of like the snowman joke was the password for the hatch. The what lies in the foot of the statue is Alana's code phrase for the Jacob army.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which, if none of that makes sense to you, don't worry, we'll get there. It's dumb.
Alana, guess what doesn't pay off? Alana.
What I would say is that they're, like, in all great stories of our time, Lost has its share of nonsense MacGuffins, and the foot is a nonsense MacGuffin until the Jacob thing, as far as I am concerned. Like, fair. until we learn that Jacob's living in that thing, doesn't matter.
There's another part of the official Lost podcast that I wanted to move to the storm, even though it aired, or it was posted the day after Live Together, Die Alone aired. But they, in the monster question I referenced earlier, where someone asked if they just forgot about the monster, their question wasn't necessarily, it was that they had more for the monster to do they couldn't fit in. But then Carlton Cuse also says, and maybe you just saw the monster and didn't know it. Is that too early to bring up for the commies?
Yeah.
The whole idea that the monster, the man in black and the monster and the... It's weird because, okay, so we're at the end of season 2, right? And I know that all that stuff's coming, but it still feels so far away. It's weird. The man in black becoming the monster... and the revelation that he has taken forms along the way, because all that did feel like a big retcon, you know, back in the day. But we'll see how it feels this time around.
Yeah, it does seem like they knew kind of what they were thinking about, but then, as Joanna's referenced in the storm before, like, Yemi and Horse are like question mark people. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's so inconsistent that it never felt like any of that mattered too much, but I guess
they had the idea of a shape-shifting monster, but I don't think they doubled down on it until next season.
Mm-hmm.
Or I don't even think that happens. I just think they use Christian Shepherd in the cabin next season, right? And that's how we sort of get the idea after season 6.
That's in season 3.
Hurley and Ben takes Locke to the cabin in season 3.
You don't see Christian Shepherd in the cabin until later
season 4
when Claire's there.
Oh. No, doesn't Hurley see Christian Shepherd through the cabin?
He sees an eye, but don't.
Yeah, he's looking at Christian Shepherd, and then the eye comes up in front of Christian Shepherd and is, like, looking right at him.
But I don't think he sees a figure in the chair, but I don't think you see that it's Christian Shepherd.
Interesting.
I feel very certain on this.
Okay. Well, when we get there, maybe I'll remember to not let you rub it in my face about being right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think if there are any Call Me's listening right now, all you need to know is that Nikki and Paolo are coming and they're amazing.
And he might be off of Westworld, but he is coming to Lost.
Okay. Lostopedia has already told me I'm wrong. So
nice. Well, see, you could have just let me forget it and I wouldn't have paid attention. All right. Good to know that I'm not going wrong. Institutionalized Dave. Okay. Is this Zach's prompt? How did Calvin participate in the invasion of Iraq during the Gulf War and join Dharma before the Purge?
No.
Okay. So we'll do that prompt now. Somebody asked this in an email. How did Calvin participate in the invasion of Iraq, which we see him with Saeed, 1991, and then join the Dharma Initiative before the Purge? The reason this is sort of wishy-washy, we found out while doing some Googling, is the Lost Encyclopedia, the printed book, sets the Purge in 1987, which makes no sense. But John Locke later has a dream that sets the Purge around 1992. So we could assume around when he leaves Saeed on the side of a very CG-looking road in Iraq to when he shows up on the island, he is like gets in and joins the Dharma Initiative right before the Purge happens. And as far as we know, Rosinski and him are the only members who survived the Purge who don't join the others. So they're the last of the Dharma Initiative, technically. Mm.
Yeah. Well, you know,
and
maybe
the guys dropping the pallets.
Maybe, you know, the stuff that he was doing in Iraq with you know, Kate's dad and Saeed made him rethink his life in the military. He went to go join sort of the Peace Corps.
Yeah, I always thought, I mean, before the rest of the seasons came out, when I saw this, I thought the way he said, like, and then join the Dharma Initiative, namaste, and all that, that he was actually not part of the Dharma Initiative. That, like, his joining the Dharma Initiative is like he ran across Radzinski, and Radzinski indoctrinated him like he indoctrinated Desmond. And then you have, like, this, like, loop of the guy brings in another guy, goes crazy, and then, like, they sort of kill each other. Like, that Neil was sort of hinting at that maybe Calvin killed Rosinski. But the show doesn't seem to play with that loop, even though it's, like, right there in front of them to play with, so.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't, it never seemed to me like the show was super interested in Calvin beyond this.
Right. It was more just like a, isn't this cool, how the universes are crossing over.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting how Jack's in the background of the Penny and Desmond scenes?
Listen, if I were working with Desmond as a character and Henry and Cusick as a handsome human, I wouldn't be worried about other people's storylines either. I'd be like, let's just get this Desmond part right.
All right. One more question for Neil, then on to your emails. Neil, This show, as we know, was written and produced very fast. Do you think they intended to keep weaving Libby into different people's flashbacks at this point in the show?
No, I actually made a joke in the live watch in the spoiler thread that we made about how every time Libby shows up going forward, because this isn't the last time, right? She shows up multiple times again.
She shows up later, yes.
Yeah, it just feels like a long, slow apology for writing her off the show, to the actress specifically. Like, That's what it always felt like to me. It's like, oh, Libby keeps showing up. Like, maybe they must have felt bad about writing her off, you know?
Well, it's like the second time So they did it once before she died with the reveal the institution. Then they did it with Anna Lucia, And now they've done it with Desmond.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems interesting that, yeah, she could have been the Richard Alpert before we had Richard Alpert, is what I'm wondering. Like, well, was Libby going to be important?
You know, in season two is sort of when the writer's room starts to fall in love with the crisscrossing of the characters in the background of flashbacks. So, I mean, just throw Libby on the pile with like them just being like, let's put more fun, weird shit in the flashbacks to make everybody constantly be searching through our flashbacks for every little detail, you know, and that's exactly what happened. So good job.
That's why we find the Where's Libby segment so funny. Mm-hmm. All right, Joanna, we got some emails, some storm emails.
I want to follow up on this cabin thing because now I'm going back and I'm saying I'm right.
Now we know what Joanna's been doing.
I went and watched the scene. So, like, Lossopedia says the guy is Christian. First of all, this scene doesn't take place till season four that Hurley goes to the cabin.
Okay.
Yeah. Right? All this all right. did feel like season four talk to me. Yeah.
And Lossopedia is like, he sees Christian. But if you watch the thing, it's like, we know it's Christian because we know it's Christian, but if you watch the scene, it's just a shadowy figure with admittedly like that, you know, that classic Christian Shepherd hairline, in the chair. And then
is it the actor?
I don't know. You really can't tell who it is though. even in like freeze frame culture, you can't tell who it is.
And Hurley definitely didn't know who it was.
Right. Like, you can go look. You can go look at the YouTube video right now. It says "Lost Hurley in the cabin," and you can go ahead and freeze it at 38 seconds in. And you tell me for certain that you would be able to swear on a stack of Jacob's Bible,
religious texts from all different religions.
So scrolls of papyrus that is Christian Shepherd.
Swear on a four-toed statue.
I will look it up while we email.
Okay. All right. So here is, an email from Cynthia who says, gives us a very nice thank you for all of our work. So I finally had to write you, over this season finale. So bittersweet. The metaphorical doors get blown open, even if the hatch doors don't. And we start to see how many rabbit holes this Warren potentially has. Even in the rewatch, it is mind boggling. And I know what's coming. What is so bittersweet about it to me is that from here on out, the core group of the first two seasons never really gets back together again in the way they were up until now. Sure, the hatchlings create some separation in this season with their flagrant bed napping and clothes washing, but everyone was still kind of connected. Now that connection just fades away. I miss it when it goes. The finale was a big, oh, right, I remember this experience for me. The pay attention or you'll miss something key or end up obsessed with a red herring vibe just washed over me. And we were like, shit, yeah, we remember how it goes from here. I'm certainly not complaining about the pace and complexity picking up, but it goes from this relatively straightforward storyline to Tokyo subway levels of where the hell am I fast. I realize I'm borderline whining. I guess I just wanted a few more lazy beach scenes before we took off into life with Ben and friends. But it's okay. We have a bunch of priceless episodes coming up, and there's so much in season three. Can't wait to hear you all weigh in on. Thanks again, and be well, Sin and Dave. So, thank you for that.
I do think that that's a really good point about there. Do feel like there you could separate some of the seasons of Lost into sort of sections. Like seasons one and two are very much kind of their own. They have their own feel to them. And how they say you can tell that their confidence starts to grow toward the end of season two as far as how sci-fi they're going to be. Season three really does have has a much different vibe to it, especially from the start, especially as we sort of just blow open the story of the others. I'm really excited about that part because Lost really changes kind of every two seasons almost into a completely different kind of show.
And this upcoming one has basically in between the airing of the Live Together, Die Alone and Comic-Con 2006 is when they made their deal to split Lost season three into they're going to premiere the next September 2006. They're going to do six episodes and they're going to take off until February 2007 and then do an uninterrupted run of 17 episodes. And so basically we know now in the storm that in that gap, that six episode gap, they're begging ABC to give them an end date. Because what they're afraid about at this point is basically doing what happened to the X-Files, which is funny because it happened in the X-Files twice. But Chris Carter is like, here's how I'm going to end it. I'm going to do the seasons. I'm going to do a movie and then we're going to be done. And maybe we'll do more movies, but the show will be done. And Fox was like, fuck no. That movie made a lot of money. This show is really popular. You are coming back. And then they did it to them, you know, again with X-Files, the revival. And it just sort of like kills the show. So at this point, Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse are worried about that. They're worried that if Lost gets too popular, the only way they'd be able to retain control over it is to like put their foot down and say they're going to leave the show. But this is also the time period, the summer of 2006, where they start talking about for the first time knowing what the final episode is. It gets kind of wishy-washy as we go through seasons as to like knowing what the final episode is, knowing what the final shot is, kind of knowing what it needs to be about. That all kind of gets washed around. But in terms of like talking about it, we know that historically it's in the gap after they shot the first, 6 episodes of season 3 that they're like, we need to pivot and get towards an end game. And that's sort of where they start massaging in the flash forwards, a lot more. But yeah. Lost changes, and I think at least now when we're in the first 3 seasons are not only reactionary to like how popular they are, but I think like a less confident method of knowing that you might have to do this for like 7 years. Whereas I like after those first 6 episodes of season three really picks up and I think gains some great confidence.
Did you watch the cabin video?
I did watch the cabin video. I think it is the actor, but no, I don't think you could tell that it's Christian Shepherd.
All right, so this email comes from Matthew, who wrote this a while ago, but he kindly wrote in again because I think I said we wanted to talk about it closer to this finale, so he kindly reminded me by writing in again. I emailed earlier in the season to suggest that Libby might be acting on behalf of Widmore when she gives Desmond the boat, and Joanna suggested it might be better to discuss after the finale. I think it's safe to assume that all of Widmore's actions towards Desmond are designed to push him to get to the island so that he can save the world using the knowledge from Daniel's book. That would be Daniel Faraday, his son. I think Joanna mentioned in a previous podcast episode that the notebook is more of a Hawking thing than a Widmore thing. However, I rewatched The Variable, and it looks like Hawking must have passed on some information to Charles. He's very active in persuading Daniel to go to the island, and he also says to Eloise that his relationship with Penny was something that he had had to sacrifice. If that is the case, then, although there are a lot of coincidences in the lives of the 815ers before they crash on the island, it seems a bit much that Libby just happens to have a spare boat at the exact point that Desmond needs one for a Widmore-sponsored boat race. So my theory is that Libby is either being paid to do this by Widmore, or at least that Charles is pulling the strings here. Perhaps he arranged David's death somehow? Matthew.
Yes.
I love this like parenthetical right at the end. Matthew's like, maybe Charles Widmore killed Libby's husband? Love it. Love to see that. I still don't think so. I think this is more to do with like the way the Lost writers are really enamored of the whole like, what a curious twist of fate, the ways in which our lives are intersected, sort of thing. So that would be my feeling on it. And honestly, if anyone's pushing anyone towards the island, I feel like it's Jacob. So maybe Jacob pushed things in one direction or another to make this happen. But
so maybe Jacob killed David?
Definitely. Jacob had Ilana kill David.
All I know is that someone killed Libby's husband.
I really feel like someone killed Libby's husband.
It is a very important Dave we know in the series that never gets addressed. I like Matthew's theory. I don't think there's anything in there that immediately disproves it that
sure.
we see.
That's true.
So we're gonna put that in the maybe pile until we get into all the Widmore flashbacks and we pay attention to the journal again.
Yeah, I promise to pay closer attention to the Faraday journal. I thought like because Eloise like leaves Charles sort of shortly after the journal. I mean, they were already broken up, but she like leaves the island and stuff like that and like seems to have nothing to do with him. He is weirdly involved in Daniel's life. I don't know. I have some questions. I have questions about Daniel Widmore and his interest in Daniel Faraday, other than the fact that it's his kid. we'll talk about it. I have one last part of Zach's email that I didn't read. Are you guys ready for this?
Let's get to it.
All right. He said, I know you have all ranked seasons of Lost, but what would you say is the best short to medium sized stretch of consecutive episodes? So I will go ahead and further narrow this down from Zach's prompt and say, like, let's say three. If you could pick a 3-episode run on Lost, what do you think is the best 3-episode run on Lost?
I'm looking up season 5.
I know.
Man.
Yeah. I'll go first since I've had time to think about it.
Go ahead.
It's hard for me to pick between 3, 4, and 5. I feel like I can find good stretches in all of those seasons, but I think it's hard. Can I count like a 2-part finale as like 2 episodes?
Sure.
Like
consecutive 3 hours, let's say, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give it to Greatest Hits and then Through the Looking Glass, which is the end of season 3. So Charlie's last flashback episode where he's making like the list of his life, and then Not Penny's boat, and blah, 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 and then the reveal and Through the Looking Glass that we're actually watching flash forwards. And my boy Mikhail is there. So, yeah, I'd say those 3 hours are my top three. Do either of you have something you want to say?
I'm going to say season 5.
Uh-huh.
Hour number 1 is 3:16. Mm-hmm. Eloise takes him to a new station.
Yes, Dave. Yes.
Tells him how to get to Ajir Airways.
Yes. And then
Life and Death of Jeremy Bentham.
Yes.
To where we get to feel bad for John Locke before discovering the bad guy's going to be wearing his face.
And then
concluding with La Fleur.
One of my top episodes. I was trying really hard to create a 3 around the floor, but I didn't make. I didn't make it.
Yeah, it's right there. 3:16. Life of Jeremy Bentham. Before there it is.
I was gonna go like La Fleur, Namaste. He's Are You, because I love the Dharmaville stuff so much. But anyway.
Oh, see, I'm more like show me this crazy conspiracy that has to do with time travel that has stations off the island. So that's why 3:16 gets in there.
Fair. Neil.
All right, I reserve the right to change this, obviously, when we get... Because I, you know, I'm going with Pilot Part 1, Pilot Part 2, and Tabula Rasa.
Ooh.
I'm still on, and this, like I said, this could change, because the deepest rewatch I've done is only to about that point in Season 3 where... They did the split, so like the 6th or 7th episode. Up to this point, I would say the first 3 episodes are still sort of the best 3 hours that we've seen of Lost yet. And that's not to say that we have not also seen a bunch of excellent stuff, because we have.
That's, I think that's a really solid answer. The other 3 stretch that I was considering, is season 4. The Constant, The Other Woman, which is a Juliet episode, mm-hmm. and then Ji-Yun, which is Sun and Jin, and that's that one where like you think Jin's trying to race the hospital for his own baby's death, but it turns out that's a flashback, and it ends with them at Jin's grave with Hurley, and it's so sad. So like The Constant and Ji-Yun are like all-timer episodes for me. The Other Woman, it's a Juliet episode, so it gets a pass for me, but like I don't really need Juliet and Goodwin's, and plus it has a lot of Charlotte, which is just too much Charlotte for me. So yeah, The Other Woman.
I can't wait to find out if my love of Charlotte is going to survive this rewatch. It's so far, it's like 50-50.
Maybe Charlotte will be like a top drawer. We can fight about Charlotte every week. It'll be
Charlotte antagonist chicken.
I mean, she's beautiful. So if you're like, I have a crush on her, I'm like, I get it, man. She's gorgeous, ginger.
Ooh,
love it.
A moist Charlotte corner.
Jesus.
File that under no.
All right, I think that's gonna wrap it up for the storm. Neil, do you want to reveal how you were clever with your opening answer on this week's podcast?
Yes, next week we are going to explore A Tale of Two Cities, which is the title of the season 3 premiere. It is a Jack episode. Please hold your applause.
Yes, it is.
Wait, when's the last time we had a Jack episode? It feels actually like it's been a while.
That was a point that David Sims pointed out, that there were like, I think there's only like 2 Jack episodes in season two.
Season two, the first one, episode one, Man of Science, Man of Faith, and then The Hunting Party, 11. So it has been 13 episodes since we've had a Jack flashback.
We have lost and regained and lost a whole Michael in that period.
Exactly. And a Walt.
But most importantly, well, two really important things happen in next week's episode.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, we learn Henry Gale's real name.
Mm-hmm.
Ben.
But number two, more importantly, we meet the lovely Juliet.
Juliet!
That's true. Juliet Ascendant.
Dr. Juliet Burke!
Can't wait. Juliet is the best.
All right, until then, where can people find more of our work online? Let's start this week with Joanna Robinson.
Oh, you can find me on vanityfair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. And I do a bunch of other podcasts like Little Gold Men and Still Watching. And
can you just announce a new one?
I did just announce a new one. It premieres in June. It's called Truth Versus Hollywood. I have a little trailer. Do you want to hear it?
Yeah.
I mean, I think they heard it before the storm spoiler part. That would make sense to me.
Yeah, exactly.
You heard it. Humming. You heard the trailer.
You heard it already.
You will have heard it by the time you listen to this. We time travel.
That's right. Neil Miller.
Well, you can always get me over at filmschoolrejects.com, on Twitter, at rejects, at one perfect shot. And don't forget to follow the show at Storm Podcast. We've got all kinds of fun things happening. And if you like Breaking Bad, join our Patreon and watch Breaking Bad with us. It's the most fun.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can also find me on the Fighting in the War Room podcast, which is approaching our 300th episode, which is a fucking long podcast. And I've been drinking iced coffee during this podcast and have to go to the bathroom. So you know how this goes. Don't fall down.